Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you a prolific love affair between the church and art. The picnic that led to that breach in the Berlin Wall. And music from a modern opera focusing on the figure of St. Francis of Assisi. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. At a press conference on Thursday, 5th of November in the Vatican, the names of the artists meeting with Pope Benedict XVI on the 21st of November in the Sistine Chapel were finally revealed. Artists, Catholics and non-Catholics alike from all disciplines, such as Peter Greenway, Amy Stewart, Martin Baker, Bill Viola, and so many more. Another project unveiled at the press conference was that of the plans for the Holy See to have its own pavilion at the Venice Biennale in 2011, not commissioning art in the Renaissance sense, perhaps, but inviting artists to produce work for this venture on a specific theme. Still to be decided. As we know, the Vatican's interest in contemporary art was first rekindled almost half a century ago by Pope Paul VI, back in May 1964, during a historic meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel. An interest, this, in faith and art, which was also highlighted by Pope John Paul II in 1999 in a letter to artists. So, getting back to the present pontificate, when artists gather around Pope Benedict XVI in the Sistine Chapel later this month, it will be in the footsteps of these two popes. At any rate, what I'll be doing in a few moments is taking you back 45 years, beginning by speaking to a personal friend of Paul VI, Cardinal Edmund Schoker, as well as to our cultural expert and friend, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who for many years worked as an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture. And of course, I'll be letting you hear Pope Paul's voice once again at that historic meeting. But let's begin by listening to Cardinal Schoker.
There was historically that connection between the church and art, but then there was an estrangement for some time, and Paul VI wanted to recall that, to bring back that relationship that had existed for centuries.
American Cardinal Edmund Schoker knew Pope Paul VI personally. I asked him what it was in Paul VI's personality that made him such a patron of art and artists. Cardinal Schoker says it stems from a combination of great sensitivity and radiant spirituality.
It does not surprise me that he would have a great interest in art because of his deep spirituality and because art ultimately expresses the spiritual. And I think that it'd be just a sort of natural consequence of his own deep spirituality and his ability to see beyond the material to the transcendence of everything. I think it was a natural consequence of that ability that he would have such a great interest in art.
In our increasingly secular society, that concern for a greater affinity between art and faith is something Pope John Paul highlights in his letter to artists. In particular, he mentions one date this century which was especially significant in bridging the gap between art and the Catholic Church.
Sono mai venuti gli artisti a Papa? È una prima volta anche questa, forse.
Have artists ever gathered around a pope like this before? Pope Paul VI's gentle voice questions the artists he's invited to join him in the Sistine Chapel. It's May the 7th, 1964. The occasion is unusual, a mass for artists in the cenacle of artists.
Proprio per noi, non come gente che sta nelle quinte, ma che viene davvero.
Paul VI is out to provoke. He knows all too well that for centuries the church and art had enjoyed an extremely prolific love affair. But what he's forced to admit is that at some stage that love affair dwindled, marking a decline destined to last for almost two centuries. As he says this, his voice wavers wistfully.
Come avviene fra parenti, come avviene anche fra amici. ci si è un po' guastati. Non abbiamo rotto, ma abbiamo turbato la nostra amicizia.
I was fascinated to read that speech by Pope Paul because the church had lost its way a little bit with artists. There was no more patronage in the Renaissance sense. All the energy seemed to go on stressing the mind and the consistency, the logic of what the church had to teach. Very much a world of words, whereas the images lost out.
Cultural expert Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. During that speech, the Pope says that the church abandoned artists, but the artists abandoned the church as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they'd each gone their own way. He wanted to apologise, which is a remarkable thing. You don't often hear that from a Pope. And it was a very humble, avuncular kind of speech. He was saying, the Pope's your friend. I really want you to be sure of this, that you're very welcome in the church and we should get back together. You've gone off by losing the standards that you used to hold so dear and stopped reflecting a beauty that mattered very much to the church.
Ci avete un po' abbandonato, siete andati lontani a bere ad altre fontane.
The Pope's voice is hesitant and shy as he begins chastising artists for abandoning the church. But before long, the strength of the Pope's commitment to art surfaces from that silent shyness, spiraling into a cry of vehement reproval.
Dimenticate il canone fondamentale della vostra consacrazione all'espressione. Non si sa che cosa dite, non lo sapete tante volte neanche voi. Diventa un linguaggio di Babele, di confusione.
No longer does he whisper, I don't want to offend you here today, but you did lower your standards, lost sight of true inspiration. Your art became offensive to humanity. And what is the result? Confusion, a Tower of Babel.
Artists had gone their own way, in a way that really he thought the church couldn't always approve of, like not looking to standards of decency or beauty. In the classic senses, the effect of different currents of thought left its mark on the church as well, and there was too much rational thinking taking over. And the thing that lost out was the emotional side, or the more explicitly artistic side in people's character.
Riconosceremo che anche noi vi abbiamo fatto tribolare.
But while Paul VI does rap artists over the knuckles, he also admits to the church's responsibility, its failure to foster art, a failure that brought the church's image as patron of art and artists to an end. Paul VI explains why. He attributes it to a clash between artists' boundless creativity and the church's imposition of styles and limiting rules and regulations in the field of art. As Paul VI insisted almost half a century ago, joy, hope, exhilaration, these are the emotions that speak to people of God. He was desperately determined in his desire to bring modern associations to a long-lost relationship between the church and art. A decade later, he would inaugurate the Gallery of Modern Art in the Vatican Museums. It was the 23rd of June, 1973. And the only great artist of the 20th century who declined to grant him one of his masterpieces was, well, Picasso. A big thank you there to my guests, Cardinal Edmund Schoker and Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. And now moving on in the broadcast, as celebrations are taking place all over Europe to mark the 20th anniversary of the breach of the Berlin Wall, which led to the reunification of Eastern and Western Germany, I'd like to find out more about a picnic. Yes, yes, the so-called Pan-European picnic, which led to this historic moment. Stay tuned. 20 years ago, for Hungarians living on the Austro-Hungarian border, freedom may have been at the other end of their vineyards, but it definitely belonged to a world beyond. Beyond what? Well, kilometres of barbed wire, along what was part of the so-called Iron Curtain drawn across Europe, one which divided Europe in half, separating East from West. And one carefully patrolled by border guards, both on the ground and high up in threatening-looking watchtowers. But in May 1989, something changed. The Hungarian government passed a decree approving the demolition of that iron curtain, along its borders anyway. And as these winds of change gathered over Hungary, word of these winds reached East Germany, where the people, thousands of them, little by little, embraced the news trickling through the border to Hungary, eager to flee the grips of the stricter Soviet regime in place in their home country. They came with their families, filled camping sites, more famously squatted at West Germany's embassy and consulate in Budapest, or merely relied on help in their status as refugees. All in all, their massive presence across Hungary created an issue for the Hungarian government, one to be solved. And then, in August of that same year, there was a breakthrough. A seemingly curious event was organized at Sopron, close to the Austrian border. A picnic referred to as the Pan-European Picnic. In an effort to find out more about this special picnic, which so changed the course of history, I turned to Walburga Habsburg Douglas, today a member of the Swedish Parliament, but in 1989, one of the key players in the organization of this picnic. Let's listen to what she told me.
20 years ago, precisely on the 19th of August 1989, the vigil of St. Stephen, which is a national holiday in Hungary, you were in this nation and present at the so-called Pan-European Picnic in Sopron, just miles from the Austro-Hungarian border. This picnic, which was patronised by your own father, Otto Habsburg, president of the Pan-European Union at the time, was one which marked a milestone in the lead-up to the reunification of Germany. Can you tell me how the idea of this picnic, which changed the course of history, came about, and what the intentions of those like yourself who were engaged in this initiative were at the time, of course?
I mean, definitely. It was like this, that the intentions in the beginning were not, as it turned out to be, that it became the biggest mass exodus since the building of the wall in Berlin. In the beginning, it was the idea that my father had when he was in Eastern Hungary to give a speech there. One should organize a meeting on the Austro-Hungarian border where it should be sort of shown that Hungary is a part of Europe, Hungary should be a part of Europe, and Hungary must again find its place in Europe. So the idea was to make a meeting between two mayors and between the people from Austria and Hungary on the border. Because at the time when this was thought, that was the 20th of June, there still was not such an incredible strong influx of East Germans. And when this picnic was planned, precisely 1 week later, Julia Horn and Alois Mock, the then foreign ministers of Austria and Hungary, had a historical meeting in Klingenthal, also at the Austro-Hungarian border, where they symbolically cut into the barbed wire. And so we decided that this would be a fantastic possibility if we also might do the same thing. And so when the picnic was organized, we asked whether it would be possible to cut the barbed wire and sort of mount down the Iron Curtain, besides obviously opening a gate in the border. And during the weeks after this planning, when the planning started, the East Germans came into Hungary during their holidays, summer holidays, to try and find a place to escape from the Eastern Bloc. And Hungary seemed to everybody to be the precisely best place. And we, who were all co-organizers in the picnic, decided that it would be perhaps a good idea to invite these East Germans to come to the border on the 19th and participate at the picnic. Then we obviously had started to have the idea that this might be a chance for the East Germans to leave the country. So this was how the idea came into being. And besides my father, the picnic had another patron, and this was the then Vice Premier Minister of Hungary, Imre Posgoy. So we also had somebody from the official Hungarian government included in the preparations.
You yourself were involved in the preparations, weren't you?
Obviously, because I was in Hungary to learn Hungarian. And since I was representing the Pan-European Union, and since the picnic is called the Pan-European Picnic, we were co-organizers of the picnic. So I was involved, and I knew a little bit what was going on.
Can you describe the picnic? I mean, the photos I've glanced at.
Oh, yes, very, very, very well. The thing was that the idea was that there should be a picnic. The gates should be opened for a couple of hours. The two mayors of the adjacent cities of St. Margrethen in Austria and Ferenc Rákos in Hungary could shake hands and sign a paper of eternal friendship. Then there should be a meeting between the Austrians and the Hungarians, and it would be possible to cross the border at that place. But what happened was that first there was a big press conference, and from this press conference, we, the participants, went towards the gate, and the gate was supposed to be open, as the program said, in the afternoon at a certain hour. But when we came there, the gates had already been pushed open by the East Germans, who fled out of Hungary into Austria, into liberty. And so for them, for those who fled, it was not a picnic, it was a big chance for fleeing the hated system in the East. For us, it was a possibility to help them flee and then be present and see what happened, and perhaps through our presence see that it didn't become a dangerous situation, that everything went on sort of rather well organized. And when the gates were closed again, which was after about 2.5 hours, we had the picnic, which was that we met on a lawn close by the border with speeches of the representatives of Imre Posgoy and my father, in that case me, and a couple of poets, of Hungarian poets and important cultural personalities. We who were there, we knew that something great had happened, because when you saw the faces of the people who fled into liberty and who obviously did not have the required papers to leave the East, when you saw their faces and their incredible joy to be able to leave communism behind them, when we approached the border, at both sides of the little road, there were masses of East German cars standing, the Trabants. At that time, we all knew that if you wanted to buy a Trabant in Eastern Germany, it would take you about 13, 14 years. And if the people just left this thing standing in the East and were themselves running into the West, you understood that they were really ready to start something entirely new, a new life.
Is there anything which struck you at an emotional level?
I was often asked whether I was scared that something would happen. No, it was such an incredible, deep, deep, deep joy that they really had found the hole in the Iron Curtain. Also sort of very emotional was how the border police reacted. They would have reacted wrongly and, for example, decided that they would have to use force against the fleeing people. But they decided that they wouldn't do it, that they decided against using force. They decided that they couldn't do anything with their bare hands to stop the fleeing persons. We were very lucky because the Russians had drawn back the Red Army from the western border of Hungary.
Clearly it's not just the picnic that changed the course of history. There was a political build-up to it, wasn't there?
Absolutely. There were many, many, many things that helped to sort of topple the Iron Curtain, starting by the election of the Polish Pope. That definitely was the most important single factor, I think, at least. But then also with Ronald Reagan in the United States, that was another very important happening, and Helmut Kohl in Germany. These three statesmen had a very important task in changing the course of history. And I mean, especially Poland was an extremely important thing, because in Poland, not only did they sort of get a new self-esteem through the Pope being from Poland, but they also were the first ones who were capable of organizing free elections behind the Iron Curtain, the free elections that were held on the 4th of June of 1989, and in which the Solidarność got 99 out of 100 places in parliament. Then was the picnic, obviously, and after the picnic, there were many other events like this human chain along the Baltic states. But the thing was that there were many, many different single happenings, but I would say that the picnic is a little bit special because the picnic was the first time that the people were fleeing in masses, you know, because it was over 600 people who were fleeing the East. Because before that, it had been 2 or 3 or 10 persons who left, but there it was over 600.
Getting back to Hungary, I've heard Hungarians mention how what they didn't achieve during the 1956 revolution with its bloody Soviet oppression, they achieved 40 years later in 1989. Would you agree, and why?
Well, you see, I would agree that they obviously did not achieve it in 1956, but then it was obviously also a question of world politics, because many countries in the West had promised the Hungarians to help them if they would be ready to be the rebels. And then when they were rebelling against Russia, not so many really helped them that they had promised them. And obviously the Hungarians, who always had a special role in the Eastern Bloc, because they were the first ones to allow again private property, they were the first ones to have governments where not every single member was a member of the Communist Party. And I mean, in 1989, the president of Hungary, Bruno Straub, he was not a member of the Communist Party anymore. So you see that there was a big change in this country. And then somehow the Hungarians had decided that they wanted to be the ones who changed the course of history. And I mean, now during all the meetings that we were having around the 20th anniversary, I had the chance of talking to politicians who at that time were active in Hungary, many of them having been communists, now they are no longer. And they were telling what they did and all the contacts they had to make it possible that the Iron Curtain broke down. I mean, you see, it was so anachronistic in 1989 that the Hungarians inside their parliament and government already started to adapt their new laws to the European Union ideas. But on the other hand, they still had an Iron Curtain against Austria. This is why the representatives of the Hungarian government had very close contacts with Soviet government to say, we are not willing to keep that up. I mean, if we really want this Iron Curtain to be functioning, we would have to renovate it completely, but that costs so much money, so we rather think we should tear it down. So, I mean, the Hungarians did a fabulous job.
You were listening there to Walburga Habsburg Douglas, currently a member of the Swedish Parliament. Finally, as concerts are taking place surrounding the 800th anniversary of the establishment of the Franciscan Rules, our musical expert, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, tells us about an opera on St. Francis of Assisi.
We've just been listening to a modern opera by the great French composer Olivier Messiaen. It was written in 1983, when the composer was 75 years old. Messiaen was a man of deep faith, and it came as no surprise that he chose a religious subject for this, his first and only opera. It's about St. Francis of Assisi. That was St. Francis himself, leading the friars in morning prayer. He's singing a passage from one of his most famous prayers, the Canticle of the Sun.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through all that you have made, and first my Lord, brother, Sun, who brings the day, through whom you give us light. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister moon and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright, precious and fair. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brothers wind and air, both fair and stormy, all the weather's moods, by which you cherish all that you have made. All praise be yours, my Lord, through Sister Water, so useful, humble, precious, and pure.
St. Francis's love of creatures, especially animals, has inspired many artists and musicians over the centuries. Some of you may know the lovely fresco by Giotto of St. Francis feeding the birds. Rather less well known is a short piano piece by the 19th century Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. It paints a picture in sound of St. Francis preaching to the birds. As you can hear, the birds are still quite excited at this point, but later in the piece they calm down and pay a bit more attention to the saintly preacher. St. Francis has inspired hymn writers too. His Canticle of the Sun is the basis of a popular hymn. All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing, O praise him, Alleluia. The tune is a German chorale, Lasst uns erfreuen, written in Cologne early in the 17th century. The original words were addressed to Our Lady, rejoicing that her sorrows had been banished by the resurrection of her Son. That's why there are so many Alleluias. The tune has spread to many different countries, and new texts have been supplied not only in English, but in Italian, in Portuguese, and in other languages too. It was a truly inspired choice by the country clergyman William Draper to make an adaptation of St. Francis's Canticle of the Sun to be sung to this tune. Those ringing alleluias perfectly match the joyful spirit of praise pouring forth from sun and stars, earth and seas, and from every creature of our God and King.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.